The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas. You're about to hear William Burroughs reading from Naked Lunch, followed by an interview. This program was recorded in 1975, when William Burroughs returned to New York from Tangiers, where he had been living. The program is from my archives and was originally broadcast on WBAI in New York.
I first met William Burroughs on the printed page, but of course I'd heard about him from my brother, Brian Gyson, who in the late 1950s wrote to me and said that he'd met a new friend and that he'd been helping him with his writing, working on a book.
Felicity Mason introduces William Burroughs and his work through her reminiscences about her first reactions to Naked Lunch.
And then Brown came to visit me in the summer, I should think, of 60. I was living in Rome, and I remember we were walking down the Via Veneto, and we stopped at a bookstore, and he said, "I would like to buy you a book which has just come out. It's called The Naked Lunch, and it's by my new friend, William Burroughs." It was an unlikely place to find the book amongst smart magazines on a very smart kind of jet-set international street. However, there it was in this little green cover, the Olympiad edition, and Brown bought it for me, and I took it home. And that night, I met William Burroughs for the first time on the printed page, as I was telling you. And I was a little appalled at first. I was a little frightened. It was grotesque. It certainly hit hard below the belt, and I mean below the belt. Then I got into it, found it remarkably poetic, but I didn't yet find it funny. I think it wasn't until it was explained to me that it was satire and that it was comic that I really understood that. I think the first time you come into contact with Burroughs, at least in those days, when it was really a new type of writing. Now, of course, he has imitators, and we've all read him and reread him. But in those days, it really did strike you as being, well, violent, sadistic, masochistic. So it was a great surprise to me when I finally got to Paris, which I suppose was at the end of 60 or the beginning of 61, to actually meet William Burroughs himself. I called on my brother, who had moved into a very cheap, sleazy hotel. I was horrified to see him living in such conditions. He was in this very dirty little room with it was like a cold water tenement, that hotel. You climbed up grey stairs with holes in them, with reeking, smelly jars on every floor, with rats coming out. And then finally you got up to the bedrooms, which were just little cold water bedrooms with peeling wallpapers and terrible furniture, or no furniture. And there was my brother Brown Gyson and, to my great surprise, the author of that strange book I just read, William Burroughs. A very neat gentleman he was, and I use the word gentleman advisedly, in a little trilby hat with his beautifully shined handmade shoes and an English raincoat, sitting on the bed because there was nowhere else to sit, and looking like a very quiet businessman who's maybe just lost his business. It was then that I began to realize what a witty man he was, because in that very deadpan way of his, he comes out with some very funny remarks. Poignant and witty and pertinent to any subject. And I thought, well, now I've really got to go back and read this book again. It can't have been written by this man. So I bought myself another copy, and I went back to my hotel, which was a cheap hotel, but just one step better, and I read the book again. And having talked to both of them, I realized that it was funny, satirical, and all those ghastly, gruesome aspects of life, with a capital L, that was all in there. And this time I began to laugh. And for the next 6 months, I suppose we saw each other almost daily. We usually had dinner every night. There were four of us, my brother Brian Geis and myself, a boy called Ian Somerville, and William Burroughs. Ian, who was into recording and into all kinds of interesting sound things. My brother, who's mainly a painter. And they were getting off the ground what was going to turn out to be a combination of visual art, a spoken and written art, and launching a kind of psychedelic beat movement. That was a thing that appealed to me very much about those 6 months in Paris when I was with the beat group, mm-hmm. as I suppose we can call them, yeah. In that beat hotel, that although they were all very way-out characters and mm-hmm. very strange and very peculiar by my slightly bourgeois standards, they were all very nice people. I mean, some of them were ghastly junkies, some of them were terrible pieces of trade, some yeah. of them were really way out people about to flip over anything, and some of them were gangsters, and some of them were, well, just people you wouldn't usually know, let's put it that way. But they were all essentially so human, so nice, so warm, so quiet. I mean, a lot of them were maybe characters out of William's writings, because you always use things out of your own life and personalities you've met. But basically, they were just human beings that you like to know. And I was very happy to be around all of them.
Kerouac says in Vanity of Deleuze, "I am not I am, but just a spy in someone's body, pretending these sandlot games, kids in the cow field near St. Rita's Church."
William Burroughs relates how Jack Kerouac suggested the title for Naked Lunch.
Jack Kerouac knew about writing when I first met him in 1944. He was 21. Already he had written a million words and was completely dedicated to his chosen trade. It was Kerouac who kept telling me I should write and call the book I wrote Naked Lunch. I had never written anything after high school and did not think of myself as a writer, and I told him so. I got no talent for writing. I had tried a few times, a page maybe. Reading it over always gave me a feeling of fatigue and disgust and aversion towards this form of activity, such as a laboratory rat must experience when he chooses the wrong path and gets a sharp reprimand from a needle in his displeasure centers. Jack insisted quietly that I did have talent for writing and that I would write a book called Naked Lunch, to which I replied, "I don't want to hear anything literary." The 1940s seem centuries away. I see a bar on 116th Street, a sailor at the bar who reeled over on the cue of Naked Lunch and accused us, I think Allen Ginsberg was there and John Kingsland, of making a sneering reference to the Swiss Navy. I wasn't in New Orleans, or Algiers, to be more precise, where I lived in a frame house by the river. I was it later in Mexico by the lake in Chapultepec Park. There's an island there where thousands of vultures roost apathetically. I was shocked at this sight, since I had always admired their aerial teamwork, some skimming a few feet off the ground, others wheeling way up, little black specks in the sky. And when they spot food, they pour down in a black funnel. We are sitting on the edge of the lake with tacos and bottles of beer. Naked Lunch is the only title. I pointed to the vultures. "They've given up like old men in St. Petersburg, Florida. Go out and hustle some carrion, you lazy buzzards." Whipping out my pearl-handled .45, I killed six of them in showers of black feathers. Jack just smiled. In fact, during all the years I knew Kerouac, I can't remember ever seeing him really angry or hostile. It was the sort of smile, in a way, you get from a priest who knows you will come to Jesus sooner or later. You can't walk out on the Shakespeare Squadron, Bill. Thank you. from Naked Lunch. I can feel the heat closing in. Feel them out there making their moves, setting up their devil doll stool pigeons. Crooning over my spoon and dropper I throw away at Washington Square Station. Vault a turnstile and two flights down the iron stairs, catching uptown A-train. Young, good-looking crew cut, Ivy League advertising exec type fruit, holds the door back for me. I am evidently his idea of a character. You know the type, comes on with bartenders and cab drivers talking about right hooks and the Dodgers. Call a counterman in Needix by his first name. A real asshole. And right on time, this narcotics dick in a white trench coat. Imagine tailing somebody in a white trench coat, trying to pass as a fag, I guess, hit the platform. I can hear the way he would say it, holding my outfit in his left hand, right hand on his piece. I think you dropped something, fella. But the subway is moving. So long, Flatfoot, I yell, giving the fruit his B production. I look into the fruit's eyes, take in the white teeth, the Florida tan, the $200 sharkskin suit, the button-down Brooks Brothers shirt, and carrying the news as a prop. The only thing I read is Little Abner. A square wants to come on hip, talks about pot. And smoke it now and then. Keep some around to offer the fast Hollywood types. Thanks, kid, I say. I can see you're one of our own. His face lights up like a pinball machine with stupid pink affect. Grassed on me, he did, I said morosely. I drew closer and laid my dirty, junky fingers on his sharkskin sleeve. And us blood brothers in the same dirty needle. I can tell you in confidence he is due for a hot shot. This is a cap of poison junk sold to an addict for liquidation purposes, often given to informers. Usually the hot shot is strychnine since it tastes and looks like junk. Ever see a hot shot hit, kid? I saw the gimp catch one in Philly. We rigged his room with a one-way whorehouse mirror and charged a Sosky to watch it. He never got the needle out of his arm. They don't if the shot is right. That's the way they find them, dropper full of clotted blood hanging out of a blue arm. The look in his eyes when it hit, kid, it was tasty. Recollect when I'm traveling with the Vigilante, best shake man in the industry, out in Chi. We is working the fags in Lincoln Park. So one night the Vigilante turns up for work in cowboy boots and a black vest with a hunk of tin on it and a lariat slung over his shoulder.
Oh, it'll be great.
Excellent. Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's really great that the fact of us all being together. I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In 1975, yes. William Burroughs, recently returned to the United States, joined a roundtable discussion. Allen Ginsberg introduces the participants.
Well, we're sitting around the table at BAI, our William Burroughs, whose work is being discussed as part of a series for BAI. And participants in the early publication of his work, namely Carl Solomon, formerly an editor at A.A. Wynn Publishing Company, which published...
A reader, actually.
A reader. Well, you did some editing, though.
Yeah.
Which published Junkie.
Yeah.
Maurice Gerodius, who's now in New York, who was the first publisher of Naked Lunch, The Soft Machine, and The Ticket That Exploded, which was a trilogy written in the 50s and early 60s.
Yes.
By Burroughs. And James Grauer Coltz, who has been working with Bill, taking care of answering telephone, secretarial work.
Keeps me busy.
And typing. So,
very good. Didn't Mason Hoffenberg present the first manuscript of Naked Lunch to you? I believe he did.
No.
Well, he said he urged you to publish it.
Yeah, no.
That's
it's
true.
Alan who first wrote the manuscript to me, I think, 58.
That's correct.
In Paris, where, you know, I was publishing books in the English language at the time, which were unpublishable in America.
I remember talking with you a lot about it, but
sure,
I remember
yes.
having
and,
initiated that.
And Mason did come to me and say, well, you have to publish this book. And I said, well, I mean, I would love to publish it, but I have to be able to read it first. I mean, I had great problems, not just with the prose, which was scintillating, but with the typing, which was pretty horrendous.
exactly,
yeah. I don't know what had happened to that manuscript before it reached me, but...
Well, Kerouac had typed part of it in Tangier, 57.
Obviously.
And Alan Anson had typed part of it, and I had typed part of it. But it was a composite of different typings and different...
It was dazzling, but it was difficult to make
a
head or tail of it. See.
The manuscript was
so
a mess.
I must say that I reacted very badly, and I said, well, this is great, but I mean, I just can't, you know, I can't even get a straight judgment on this book, and can you do something about it? I mean, that was our first conversation, and I remember you looked like a very elegant, dapper, young American...
Yeah, what I look like.
Sorry for this offense
to
you, but... extremely, you know, business-like, and you were doing your job as an agent, I suppose, you see. And,
still, years later.
Still doing your job as an agent. And then I said, well, come back later, bring me a better manuscript or something, you know. Then Mason came and insulted me for being so moronic, which I, you know, I accepted this, and I still accept it today. And then, several months later, you came back, Alan, with a remodeled, retyped, rearranged manuscript, which was published in 1959.
Well, I remember talking to you a lot about it, but I don't remember taking the initiative.
The point is, that the manuscript that you saw in 1958 was not even approximately similar to the manuscript that was published in 1959.
A lot of work was done, yes.
Yeah. Now, as I remember the story, you became interested after publication of excerpts in the Chicago Review and then in Big Table.
In Big Table, yes.
And that one morning, Sinclair Bayliss came to see me and said, you did want to publish the manuscript, and you wanted it in 2 weeks. So they all got busy and reorganized the material so the manuscript that you saw then was not at all the same as the manuscript that you saw in 1958, which was really fragmentary and confused.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess I must have taken the initiative to see you at the time when we were preparing material for Big Table.
Yes, that's right. And I remember the meeting very, very clearly. I had misgivings about this after that, and then the Big Table piece came out, and it reminded me about the whole thing, and we got into it, and the book was published in the 50s.
From the time that Sinclair Bayliss came to see me one morning, the book was out on the stands a month later. Now, I think that's a record in publishing.
Yes. Amazing.
Yes.
In 2 weeks, we had made the selections from really about 1,000 pages of material, which overflowed into the other books, into The Soft Machine, The Ticket That Exploded, and into Nova Express as well.
Right.
And made the selections and presented the manuscript, and you then published it in 2 weeks, got it printed.
Yes.
And out.
It's
so it was the whole thing from when we started to reorganize the manuscript to it being out on the stands was 1 month.
Well, I didn't remember that. It absolutely defeats understanding. But, I mean, nobody could do that today.
Well, as soon as you got it, I was producing it in pieces. You would send it to the printer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And when it came back from the printer, the proofs, instead of rearranging them, we took one look. Brian Geisen and Sinclair Bayliss, myself, we took a look and said, this is the order, just
leave
it the way it
is.
And this was all happening like a half block from the Seine River, within a couple of streets nearby each other from Rougy-le-Coeur to Rue Saint-Séverin, where you were.
Right.
Yes, we were right around the corner.
We were living in Rougy-le-Coeur in Paris.
Yes.
In a hotel.
Yes. I had
so it was actually a very short walk back and forth to the office and the house. It was a little neighborhood and everybody was seeing each other for coffee in the morning anyway.
Yes, everything was happening within a radius of about 300 yards or something. So
that's why it was possible. That's one reason why it was possible to do it so fast.
Yeah. Well, it was only one reason. I still don't can't understand what the rush was at the time. I mean, do you remember?
I wanted to take advantage of the publicity that was emanating from Chicago.
Big that was part of it, because there was a case going on. But I remember Sinclair Bayliss says he wants to publish and he wants to do it quickly. Can you get it ready in 2 weeks? And I said, yes, we'll do it.
What other books were you publishing that year?
Well,
what did you have around then?
1958-59 was a bit slow. You know? I mean, I had gone through a number of pretty fantastic books in the mid-50s, you know, when I started Olympia Press in 1953. My first list had a book by Samuel Beckett, a book by De Sade, I think The Bedroom Philosophers, or Justine, I don't remember which, a book by Henry Miller, Plexus, And, you know, I mean, it was a great start for a completely unknown imprint and a new publishing firm without a penny in the bank. We were very lucky. And a book by Apollinaire, sort of...
The Debauched Hospodar?
Yes, The Debauched Hospodar. We really had a nice literary list to start with.
And then you also had a whole series of books written by young Americans in Paris, which were straight comic
sure,
porn.
Sure, that was... Yeah.
Mason in...
Mason was one of them. Iris Owens was another one.
Baird Bryant.
Baird Bryant.
Yeah.
Actually, a distinct...
Candy. Yeah, Candy.
And Alex Trocchi.
And Alex Trocchi.
He wrote Helen and Desire.
And a few others. Chester Himes, but that was published under his own name. All the other ones were pseudonymous, and we invented colorful names for everybody.
Like what?
Such as Akbar del Piombo.
Norman Rubington.
That's Norman Rubington or Harold Daimler.
People still ask me if I'm Akbar del Piombo.
Yeah, we might as well.
Palmiro Vicarian. That was.
We might as well settle that.
Christopher Lowe, yes.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. What was Christopher's?
Count Palmiro Vicarian.
We might as well lay to rest the ghost of Burroughs as the author of Akbar del Piombo's work.
Yes, I mean, that's.
Once and for all.
I never understood that. I mean, why so many people have thought that William
Fuzz
Burroughs
Against Junk
had written Fuzz Against Junk. Years later, I was asked that question for the first time, whether William Burroughs had written Fuzz Against Junk. I discovered that there was a mistake in a copyright page once, in which I think you were credited for having, and it's all my fault, and I apologize profusely for that.
It just takes one.
You know, a copyright page had been misplaced by the printers, and this was the reason for which...
I never knew.
Yeah, but there was a reason, you see. I never understood until many years later.
But Norman Rubington was the author of Fuzz Against Junk.
Fuzz Against Junk, yes.
Fuzz Against Junk, and he had another book as well.
He had several books that were very funny.
I thought Fuzz Against Junk was very funny.
That was a book of collages, basically.
Yeah, he had one.
Well, it had a text.
Didn't he bring out Diane de Bremer?
Yes, but that was much later.
Diary of a Beatnik or something?
Diary of a Beatnik.
Memoirs of a Beatnik.
Yes.
I was from Los Angeles.
Yes. That was in America when 64. I tried to reestablish Olympia Press in America in the late 60s. That's much later.
Maurice, didn't you publish Zazie and the Metro in 59 as well?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. You see, after the mid-50s when I published Lolita, The Ginger Man, Candy, which came out in 58, and a number of books by Beckett and... Well, I don't know. I mean, my list was fluid and bizarre in those days. But then I think the last really important thing I did was in 59, Naked Lunch. After that, it was a downhill evolution, caused partly because I had been harassed by the French administration to the point that I was probably out of business, and also because censorship had started to recede in America, see, and it became possible, particularly thanks to Grove Press, to publish in America some of the books I had first published in France. Unfortunately, that was years after the French publication, and because of the American copyright regulation, most of those books were out of copyright and were pirated later in America by various publishers. But that was not the case with Naked Lunch. Naked Lunch and Lolita were, I think, the only two that escaped that piracy thing. So after 59, there were two other books we published by William Burroughs. The first one was Soft Machine, I think in 61 or 62, and after that, The Ticket That Exploded.
Yeah, I was around there, around 61, and I remember writing the Dust Jacket copy for one of them, I think, Soft Machine.
I don't know which one had the Dust Jacket by Brian Gysin.
It was the Soft Machine.
Soft Machine, yes.
I guess I did the Ticket.
No, the Ticket had a collage jacket that was made by Ian Somerville.
Oh, yes.
Remember?
Yes, quite, yes. Well, after that, I think the next step was the first publication in America of Naked Lunch by Grove Press, which I think was 64.
I believe so.
Yeah.
That late?
Yes.
Oh. Yes.
Incredible.
Yes, there was a long...
Incredible.
You must realize that in 59, there were still incredible problems that most American citizens have completely forgotten about. But the fact that in 59, Lady Shelley's Lover was published for the first time by Grove Press, and it was a breakthrough and a great daring thing to do. I mean, it's only 16 years ago, and it's hard to believe.
Yeah, one point I'd like to make is that most of the American literary establishment and the publishers and the editors had a sort of party line that the reason that, quote, obscene, unquote, books were not published in America was that there are not very many of them of literary merit anyway. So they were claiming that the reason that they weren't leading any kind of fight was that there were no real manuscripts of great importance anyway.
I think that's a very devious, cowardly
attitude. Well, I think for present historical memory, that point should be made that the cover story for not publishing those books was that there were no good books.
Alan, I remember the correspondence between Barney Rossett and Maurice Gerodius And Barney was saying very emphatically, if you think that Naked Lunch can be published now, you're absolutely out of your mind. Mm-hmm. It is impossible. It must be done in a series of steps, mm-hmm. starting with Lady Chatterley's Lover and then Miller.
Yeah.
And perhaps after that, depending on how the litigation
yes.
goes.
That's right. And there was a long delay in publishing yes. Naked Lunch because of all the different
litigations. And that's what he did. And I think that it was a rational approach.
I think
it worked
so,
very well.
Yes.
I mean, he slipped in Jean Genet and that gradual yes. approach and Frank Harris and, you know, a few other things. But it had to be done that way, see?
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see that, in fact, it's the publication of a number of important books like that
yes.
which really changed the mood of an entire generation and made things possible that were impossible before. Yeah. And I think that what happened by way of books was extended to all other, you know, forms of expression.
Yes, because by the time 64 came,
when
Naked Lunch was published, that was precisely the time of the great battle in New York over Lenny Bruce. That began
right.
around that
exactly.
time. Same time as the battle with movies
yes.
With Jack Smith's Flaming Creatures with New York filmmakers mm. Cinematheque and
yes.
Jonas Mekas as the protagonists against yeah. Richard Q, actually,
yes.
the guy who had censored Bruce. And I think there had been a sort of meeting of district attorneys in New York somewhere in the earlier 60s to take concerted action
yes.
against one or another of Grove's items to see if they could break mm. it.
In fact, there was a kind of conspiracy is not quite the word, but you see what I mean? There was a conscious
plan. It is the word. I mean, there was a concerted effort.
I would say concerted effort, not a conspiracy. It was very public, much publicized.
It was quite open, you know, and funds were poured into attacking publishers, and in fact, it was not expensive for the establishment side to do because, of course, they had the police and the courts at their disposal, and they could do it easily.
I mean the conspiracy, in a sense, by Barney Rossett to have planned out
yes,
which
sure.
books
there was a
progressively...
On both sides, yes, sure.
Yeah, except I don't like the word conspiracy there. I think
no, it's not.
I would say
majority.
A concerted effort.
Yeah, concerted effort.
Conspiracy, you see, does involve secrecy, whereas this was done very openly.
But it was planned. The point is that he had
sure,
planned a series of progressively
yes.
more
yes,
liberally.
Yes, yes, yes. Definitely, Barney did plan a series of steps.
He planned yeah. brilliantly, actually.
Very and quite successful.
The first step, I think, was even before Grove Press did anything about it, was the publication of Lolita in 1958, by Putnam's,
mm-hmm.
which was, I think, the first event of this sort mm-hmm. of an open challenge to censorship, which was not taken up, you see. They had to let go of Lolita because of a completely stupid, irrelevant incident of a copy sent to New York to a literary critic, which had been stopped by the mm-hmm. customs people,
mm-hmm.
and which had been released.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a letter to this customs officer after hearing about this incident, asking him if he had indeed stopped a copy of Lolita, examined that book, and released it after examining it, and he answered in the affirmative.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, one copy of Lolita had been processed through customs, mm-hmm. since the customs were one of the two federal bodies which were, you know, actively in charge of censorship, the other one being the post office.
Yes.
This created a legal situation whereby an American publisher could then publish Lolita
mm-hmm.
and have a precedent strong enough to defeat any effort to suppress the book in court.
Yeah.
It's very weird, but I mean, this is really what started the whole thing going.
There were a couple of small explosions before that. One was with Howell in San Francisco, because the
yes.
customs also stopped Howell. Then we got the ACLU and we got them back from the customs.
Yeah.
They stopped importing them. It was printed in England and then brought back to City Lights in San Francisco and the customs stopped it.
Right.
But we got it out of customs. But then a local vice squad officer picked it up from City Lights and it was prosecuted and we won a trial there. And that was while I was in Tangier in Paris visiting Bill.
But, I mean,
and then there was a big table thing, which was like a censorship battle in
right.
58.
Yes, that was,
And then another thing I remember was the battle over Lady Chatterley involved Arthur Summerfield, who was the Postmaster General, putting a copy of Lady Chatterley on President Eisenhower's desk with the dirty words and passages underlined.
Yes.
Eisenhower quoted in Time, I believe, or Newsweek, as saying, quote, terrible, we can't have that, unquote, and giving Summerfield the green light to go ahead and prosecute anywhere possible against Lady Chatterley.
Right.
So that was something that involved a couple hundred thousand dollars legal fees expended by Grove Press to defend that. Although
it's such an innocent book, too.
Yeah.
And obviously,
according to modern present days now.
Lady Chatterley's Lover didn't get as much opposition as The Tropic of Cancer, which was the next one on the list, which was published by Grove in 1960. Mm-hmm. And that's where they really had a lot of trouble with the local police, cases being started against them all around the country, and which they fought, and finally they won all the cases when the whole thing was reviewed by the Supreme Court.
There was a major case over, I guess it was Miller, That was fought in Florida by the same lawyer that fought for Bill's book, For Naked Lunch, in Boston.
You mean DeGrazia?
DeGrazia,
yes.
A federal case, I think, or the state Supreme Court, a federal case on one of the Grove books just prior to Naked Lunch.
Yeah.
I think Miller. Another thing that should be pointed out is that when Grove went over the barbed wire and got Lady Chatterley's Lover legalized, immediately all the other publishing companies in New York jumped in, I think Putnam among others, and printed their own editions of Lady Chatterley, because that was...
Well, yes, that's when the notion of public domain and copyright, etc., came up, you know, and this was a really very ugly...
All the publishers that were too chicken, or too conservative, or too cowardly, or too mercenary to actually fight for their own rights in regard to the earlier classic texts, as soon as Grove had established the classic legal nature of Lady Chatterley, they began pirating it.
Mm. So on the text of the trial of Howell, there are certain things which I take violent disagreement to. They said that I had been a drifter, you know.
Who said?
The government.
Prosecution.
I guess so. And also that Dada had been dead since 1920. Now, actually, what I was into at that time was Lettrism, which was a sort of neo-Dada that was very current in the 40s.
Is it very soon?
Of course. And I was anything but a drifter. I mean, I went to Townsend Harris.
Well, the government, remember, the government attitude in those years was to some extent expressed by J. Edgar Hoover, who made a public statement in the early 60s that the three greatest threats to America were the communists, the beatniks, and the eggheads, which I saw quoted in the New York Daily News as an editorial attacking either new culture or attacking literary publishing or attacking freedom of letters in the New York Daily News. So there was, to some extent, a concerted government conspiracy to block the opening which involved the FBI, which had started its counterintelligence program back in 1956, officially on their records.
Yes.
So that there may have been illegal manipulations by the FBI to discredit the literary community in that far back, to say nothing of the activities of the CIA in creating an international literary atmosphere which was a big wet blanket, discouraging any kind of breakthrough of either the old or the new classics that would have been considered obscene or socially deviant.
Yes, it's true that Encounter magazine, which was subsequently turned out to be partially subsidized by the CIA, was among the bitterest critics of my work and also of Maurice Girodias.
There was
an article against you in Olympia Press written by George Steiner.
Yes, right. Yes.
There was a
big controversy at the time.
We sent early chapters of Naked Lunch to Spender when he was working on Encounter. What year was that, 58, 59?
That would be 58.
Yeah, about the time that manuscripts were being asked for by Grove Press for Evergreen and by Big Table in Chicago. And Spender wrote back that the chapters that I had sent might be of interest to a psychiatrist, but not... We're not literary material. That's we went over this last time.
Yes, so we did.
That's typical of Stephen Spender.
You were the first also to publish Jenna in English, were you not?
There had been a privately printed edition of
Holiday
of the Flowers.
Which Carl had a copy of in the York State Psychiatric Institute in 1948.
That I bought in the Gotham Bookmark under the counter.
Published by a Cocteau protégé whose name was Morien, and who started shortly after that the Club Méditerranée and made a fortune that way, which he didn't do as a publisher. But he was trying to run a very interesting bookstore and small publishing outfit, and he was the first one to publish the book in English, which was
Freckman's translation.
Yes,
it was. It was.
And then, but that was, was a few hundred copies, and it was never really put on sale in bookstores at all.
Well, it's amazing that copy that Carl had. I saw and Kerouac saw.
Oh yes.
So it had a tremendous effect on us.
I came into contact with Genet's work. I was in Paris. In 1947, I had jumped ship, and I had a girlfriend there, a prostitute, around Pigalle. And she took me to see a Genet play, so then I wanted to read Genet in French, and I bought Pomme Funèbre.
Yes.
And I was yeah. really carried away by it. I thought it was great.
Yeah. Well, he was a great discovery for French. In terms of French letters at the time, I mean, it was something so important.
That late 40s also? Or mid 40s?
That was the late 40s.
Yes. So it's funny that it made an impression here just that time, too.
Yes.
At least on us, a small circle of people, actually.
I suppose, the first shock of that sort that the French had was Céline before the war. See, and, but there was nothing else that... provocative and that intense
in French letters.
In French letters, until Genet came out, and who's another of my authors. Since I published two or three of his books. I mean, Our Lady of the Flowers, the Seas Journal. I mean, those two I did, and I got in serious trouble because of Genet. At the same time as the French version of. Of his books was published by Gallimard, who was a great, important, wealthy literary publisher in Paris.
But didn't Gallimard publish edited versions of Genet in French?
No, they were
Pure texts.
They were the complete text, and my English version was banned, and I was prosecuted for it, which doesn't make quite much sense. But that was another illustration of what we were saying earlier, that at the time. There was really not just an effort in America to stop, the liberation of writing and thinking, but it was really an international effort. My problems in Paris started with the British government bringing pressure through Interpol and the French government to stop me from publishing those horrible books in English.
Traveler's Companions, which people were carrying across the channel.
Sure, which were a mixed bag in which I had some... more or less phony, amusing pornography written by, some very good writers who were doing this as a lark. And
to make some money, because they were all starving in Paris.
And to make some money, of course. And it was interspersed with books such as Lolita and others, which I could only sell because I was selling them as if they were dirty books. It was the only way to get those nice tourists to grab a copy and pay the 9 francs that we charge for that. So, of course, I mean, we had to take the position that we were publishers of pornography, which we were to a large extent, and very proud to be that at the time. But there was also a counter effort to stop us, and to completely wipe me out of existence, because I was the only publisher in the world who was able to publish books in English and who, made an effort to select his books and to try to give an audience to good writers. So this is how, after years and years of litigation, I was completely run out of business by the French administration, which took my case seriously because they had been told that it was important by their British colleagues and presumably also their American colleagues. I'm sure that there was a...
Well, if Summerfield was taking the matter up with President Eisenhower and they were having such a shock reaction in the Oval Office, then obviously it was an international plot.
Yeah. Sexual freedom is the key to all the other freedoms.
Yes, I think that is a very, very good point.
Maurice Gerodius of the Olympia Press in Paris, Carl Solomon, the reader instrumental in publishing Burroughs at Ace Books, James Brouwerholtz, Burroughs' literary agent, and Allen Ginsberg, who tried to find Burroughs a publisher in the United States.
I think that Wilhelm Reich has made this point as well in his book, The Sexual Revolution. But I think from their point of view, it is very rational.
Yeah.
That this is a menace to their position, that the Cultural Revolution is the important revolution, that this has taken place. Of course, as we know in Russia, even in Tsarist days, they were always oriented towards the control of thought. They regarded this as highly important.
You also know that one of the aims of the revolution at first was sexual freedom,
The Russian Revolution.
Free love,
yes.
And the Bolsheviks immediately wiped it out from the revolutionary program because it was a factor of social disorder and, you couldn't control a sexually free.
Well, in fact, the Bolsheviks in 1917 repealed all the laws against sexual perversion, so-called, and homosexuality, and it wasn't until the years of Stalin that these laws were reinstated. Now, this is only what's on the books. In practice, it may have been...
In practice, I think that, you were absolutely forced to get married, and I mean, you were forced by social, professional, pressures all around you to lead a completely straight life, and And morality among communists is still, you know, an iron rule. I mean, you just can't deviate. And if you do, I mean, you really get in trouble with the party. I mean, no person in authority in the party can have mistresses and things like that.
We had a theory that in the Western world, what was the reason for such concerted action that would have stretched through Interpol, through Arthur Summerfield, the postmaster, through President Eisenhower, through the British, the Home Ministry?
Yes, well, I think that...
What was their motive, do you think?
I think their motive was the suppression of any discussion, any free discussion of sex. I mean, remember the problems that Freud himself had, in those same years or before those years. I mean, it's he was fighting the same fight, in fact, you see, which now we have forgotten the political aspects of that fight that Freud and all his followers were fighting at the time. It was exactly the same the same thing. And I think it springs from the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, particularly in England, which was the most, you know, conservative and repressive country in Europe, in the world at the time, and the necessity to keep the working classes well disciplined, and mm-hmm. the notion that sexual freedom would destroy the social order completely, because to force people to follow moral rules in their sex life was the only way to impose the same moral rules in terms of politics and social conduct. And I think it was, you know, a sort of package that was imposed, and the way to impose this was by sexual repression and forbidding people to read certain books. So you had the British society in the Victorian era split in two. The working classes were not allowed to read anything, and the upper classes were having a good time, quite deviously, and
enjoying privately printed deluxe editions of Jack Annie Hill.
Absolutely. And this was not the French attitude at all, you see. France was, before the Second World War, was probably the only really free country in the entire world. But then it was practically knocked out of existence by Germany, by the German army, and was subjected to the rule of the German army for the 4 years of occupation, during which the French middle class got the taste of censorship and found out what they could do with censorship. And after the war, after Pétain's disciple, de Gaulle, came into power, he just adopted the rules that Pétain had followed during the war, which was to apply censorship, not just political censorship or military censorship, but moral censorship as well, see? So this is really, in a very practical and historical sense, a fascist weapon, you know, to keep the masses under control.
Probably authoritarian would be a better word there, because we're applying this equally to the condition in Russia as well as to the West.
Yes, well, fascist is a pretty loose term. And
police bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is the word they use behind the Iron
yes,
Curtain.
Yes, right.
Well,
yes.
I was a Stalinist for a while. I got into trouble with that shortly after the war, and slightly during the war.
What kind of trouble?
I had trouble with Trotskyites, mostly.
I mean, trouble over, you know, your literary tastes?
I was called a Stalinist goon at one point.
That's a nice one.
That rankles, still rankles.
Of course, during the time, the period we're discussing, 48,
yeah.
was also precisely the time when Wilhelm Reich, whom Bill just mentioned.
Right, he's another great, instance of
books
this persecution, you know, and yeah. he was really forced to his end, to his death, you know, by this persecution.
Well, what was Reich's thesis, Bill? You mentioned in the book The Sexual Revolution. What was his thesis?
Well, it was very similar to what Maurice has just put forward. Mm-hmm. That I think he applies it also to the matter of housing. You see, the more sexual suppression, the more rooms people need, and therefore you can sell them, get them living in larger apartments.
Yes.
So now that there's a housing shortage, it's advantageous to encourage orgy, and therefore advantageous to...
That's only plays a role, you know. Yeah. But I mean, in my case...
I never heard that one.
It was pretty atrocious, because I was publishing books in English, in France. I mean, that the French police are absolutely unable to understand the English language. I mean, I mean, even recently, it was sort of a known language in France, and the judges even less, and I was being, prosecuted and sentenced for books in English that the judges could not read, see, and, this gave rise to all kinds of very strange court scenes, where... But this was not, just an accident. It's, if the French authorities were trying so hard to suppress me and my production, it was, purely because of that, because I was a dangerous element in a well-organized society, see? And the Interpol was playing this wonderful role of liaison between the various police forces of England, America, France, Italy, the other countries.
How do you know it was Interpol? Precisely.
Because I saw files on me,
Interpol files.
Yes.
What's Interpol?
International Police.
Yes.
International.
Yes.
You saw files, actually.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, the French police more or less willingly let me see some of the files, denouncing me. And in particular, just before Lolita was banned, which was my first big brush with the French authorities, I saw a file and a letter from the British police.
British police.
Addressed through Interpol,
right.
To the French police, right. To the French Sûreté, asking them to do something about me and stopping this crazy activity that I was engaged in Paris.
Yeah, and the point I was making before was that if Summerfield, the Postmaster General, actually approached Eisenhower in his White House office
right.
to put pressure, and White House gave the go, and Eisenhower gave the go-ahead to prosecute on Lady Chatterley,
yes.
then it must have involved a very large police bureaucracy push in every direction.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I'm sure that
matter of high state.
I'm sure that Hoover was playing a very positive role in all that, and was really trying very hard. I mean, he was the great fighter against pornography and obscenity mm-hmm. and any kind of deviance.
I think that the point that Maurice has made, and I've always said the same, that all censorship is political.
Mm. Yes, there's
basically.
No such thing as moral censorship per se. I mean, it's always, meant for, to serve the purpose of a ruling class
ruling
or
class,
a party
yeah.
or a...
But that attitude in England, I've heard this directly from the upper English class as well. It's all right for us to read books like this, but we don't want them to get into the hands of the working class.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
About my book, for example.
Yeah.
I can say, yes, I enjoy reading it, but I wouldn't want to see it in the hands of the working class.
Well, what are their reasoning on that, or do they ever propose a reason?
Just that. They don't want the working class to think. It's as crude as that. I've heard this also from upper class English. We just don't want them to think. We want to keep them in ignorance, in those very words.
And if reading is a secret pleasure, I mean, it's the first one to be suppressed.
Well, the conclusion, or the principe that I would derive from all of our experience, is that there's a great fluctuation back and forward in this question of liberty, and that the old American saying, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, would be a good thing for later generations to bear in mind, that you can't take it for granted that the ruling classes will allow questionable works to circulate freely. You always got to fight for them, and probably will still have to continue battling for the next decade or so, especially as there'll be greater and greater repression as an economic comes across.
Certainly. Well, I at some point, of course, it becomes difficult for the ruling class to take back liberties which they have.
You'd think so, but before Cardinal Spellman died, a very important speech in Denver saying that he could see the day coming when there would be a rollback of these libertarian licenses to the mid-50s. And that was his phrase. He wanted to see it all rolled back.
Well, there's only one way that it could be rolled back.
Well, they'd have to ban the books, bring out a bunch of police, and arrest people for possession.
You can't do that.
No, they would not. They would have
burn
to
them.
War.
Yeah.
It's the only way.
Right.
So that's what happened in France, for example.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
It could only be done through a war.
You have to have a military regime in charge,
yeah.
And then they know exactly how to
put a military regime in without a war.
Yeah, look what they are doing in Chile now. I mean, it's, that's a good example. I mean, you could really draw a map of the world, a very precise map with the degree of freedom in each country, estimated in the number of obscenity cases courts carry. You have the Greek junta who comes into power, immediately miniskirts are banned.
The Greek junta, yes.
It's as silly as that,
Yeah.
Sexuality is dangerous. I mean, it's...
well, one fantasy I had very early in the game, in the mid-50s and late 50s, was that once a few of these books were put through, like Lady Chatterley, or I was thinking of that in the case of Howell, and then once Naked Lunch got out, once those books were out and Henry Miller was out in hundreds of thousands of copies in paperback and secretly hidden in people's bookshelves and dining rooms and attics, they'd never be able to completely roll everything back because there'd always be these artifacts which younger generations would pick up on secretly within the family.
Yes, I mean, you know, in a healthy society, I mean, the desire to fight the rules is so strong that freedom is bound to win, see? But it takes it can take several generations, and well, those generations, it's a waste of time, and it's a wasted lives, you know.
But
look,
see,
what happened for two or three generations in the Soviet Russia. I mean,
when I speak of a war, I mean a major war.
Yeah.
I mean a war, say a war with China or Russia. Because the Vietnam War, of course, has had very much the contrary.
All I do with dirty bucks up at Corvettes is to wipe them off.
They have some. Well, yes, they have some.
No, the dirty ones.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Round. I've been through the experience of the French occupation and the war in France and the occupation by the Germans. And I can assure you that it's absolutely devastating to see how a completely free country, educated and raised and, you know, in the culture of freedom, you know, and in the respect of absolute freedom, individual freedom, can turn around, you know, in a few months and become a, you know, a nation of slaves and idiots. I mean, it's dazzling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess there is that point, though, that they never will be able to completely suppress the new liberated mind because there are all these copies around.
Yes.
So that little pubescent boys in 1980 will be able to go up in the attic and find grandfather's...
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, there are too many books around to...
To completely obliterate and amnesiaize the situation anymore.
Clem and Jody, two old-time vaudeville hoofers, cope out as Russian agents whose sole function is to represent the U.S. in an unpopular light. When arrested for sodomy in Indonesia, Clem said to the examining magistrate, "'Tain't as if it was being queer. After all, there's only gooks.' They appeared in Liberia dressed in black Stetsons and red suspenders. So I shoot that old nigger, and he flop on his side, one leg up in the air just a-kickin'. Yeah, but you ever burn a nigger? They're always pacing around Beatonville, smoking huge cigars. Have to get some bulldozers in here, Jody, clean out all this crap. Morbid crowds follow them about, hoping to witness some superlative American outrage. 30 years in show business, and I never handled such a routine like this. I gotta dispossess a Beatonville, give myself a bang of H, piss on the black stone... make with a prayer call whilst dressed in my hog suit, cancel land lease, and get fucked up the ass simultaneous. What am I, an octopus already? Clem complains. They're conspiring to kidnap the Blackstone with a helicopter and substitute a hog pen. The hog's trained to give the Bronx cheer when the pilgrims show. We try to train them squealing bastards to sing three cheers for the red, white, and blue, but it can't be done. We connect for that wheat with Ali Wong Chapultepec in Panama. He tells us it is a high grade of shit this Finnish skipper die in a local jump joint and leave this cargo to the madam. She was like a mother to me, he says, and those were his last words. So we buy it in good faith off the old gash, laid 10 pieces of H on her. Good H, too, good Aleppo H. Just enough milk sugar to keep her strength up. We should look a gift horse in the ass already. Isn't it true that when you got to Hassan you gave a banquet for the Kaid and served couscous made from the wheat? We sure did. And you know those citizens were so loaded on that marijuana, the old wig in the middle of the banquet. Me, I just had bread and milk, ulcers, you know, likewise. So they all run around screaming they is on fire, and the bulk of them die the following morning. And the rest the morning after that. What they expect already when they rot their cells with Eastern vices. Funny thing, those citizens turn all black and their legs drop off. Horrible result of marijuana addiction. Very same thing occurred to me. So we deal directly with the old Sultan who has been a well-known ladder. After that, everything is plain sailing, you might say. But you wouldn't believe it. certain disgruntled elements chased us right down to our launch, handicapped somewhat by lack of legs and a condition in the head. Hassan is a notorious liquefactionist and suspected to be a secret sender. Shucks, boys, he says with a disarming grin, I'm just a blooming old cancer and I gotta proliferate. He picks up a Texas accent associating with Dryhole Dutton, the Dallas Wildcatter, and he wears cowboy boots and a 10-gallon hat at all times, indoors and out. His eyes are invisible behind black glasses, his face smooth and blank as wax above a well-cut suit, made entirely from immature, high-denomination banknotes. 20 years I've been a martyr to dyspepsia.
You've been listening to William Burroughs reading selected passages from Naked Lunch. The author was introduced by Felicity Mason. The roundtable discussion of the difficulties encountered in publishing the works of William Burroughs included the author, Maurice Gerodius, his first publisher, Carl Solomon, who placed Burroughs' novel with Ace Books, and James Grauerholtz, Burroughs' literary agent. The discussion was moderated by Allen Ginsberg. This program was produced by Charles Ruas and Bill Cortum, with technical direction by David Rapkin and Peter Zanger. Thank you for listening.
Listening to poet Allen Ginsberg, hosting writer William Burroughs, publisher Maurice Gerodius, instigator Carl Solomon, Burroughs' literary agent James Grauerholtz, and Brian Geisen's adopted sister Felicity Mason in a 1975 recording of anecdotes, recollections, and projections on publishing, politics, and culture. This program was produced by Charles Ruas for WBAI Radio and was restored and posted exclusively by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.